High of 69, a northwest wind at 10, becoming easterly. The weekend looks great, mostly sunny skies tomorrow. Just a slight chance for some showers. Tomorrow's high 73, the normal for this time of year, by the way, is 62. Then for Sunday, sunny and cooler, closer to those norms, Sunday's high 63. Right now, 59, I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow is May the 4th, and tomorrow evening at 7:30 p.m., the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra is presenting its next concert, and it is a concert titled May the 4th Be With You, and will feature a plethora of wonderful movie music, including music of John Williams from the Star Wars franchise. And I am really excited to be able to spend part one of today's morning show talking about tomorrow night's concert with three gentlemen very much involved with it, starting with Peter Rodriguez, who is president of the board of directors of the Kenosha Symphony and also a member of the French horn section. We're going to find out from him about some general matters related to what promises to be a very exciting concert. Later, we'll be talking with the conductor of the concert, Maestro Robert Hasty, and we'll also be hearing from the symphony's concertmasters, Sasha Mandel, who is going to be performing the Schindler's List violin solo that is, of course, one of the most beautiful, radiant things that John Williams ever composed. But first, Pete Rodriguez, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Good to talk to you again.
It might be worth spending just a few moments talking about what I think for most people is fairly obvious by now, but for the sake of anybody who might not be a Star Wars aficionado, explain why tomorrow night's concert is titled May the 4th Be With You, and sort of the idea behind the concert's approach.
Sure. When we were planning this concert roughly a year ago, we realized the concert was going to fall on May the 4th, and the title ties into one of the themes in Star Wars, where characters tell each other, "May the Force be with you."
So it's become kind of an unofficial Star Wars holiday of sorts. And I know I, for one, always wear one of my Star Wars ties on May the 4th, whatever day it might be. And of course, it's a great excuse to play some music from Star Wars and from some other great film scores as well. As a member of the orchestra, tell us what a concert like this is like. I suspect that maybe some people in the audience jump to the erroneous conclusion. I assume it's an erroneous conclusion that just because you're not playing some Beethoven symphony, that this is actually an easy gig for the symphony, relatively easy music to play. I suspect it's actually a bit of a challenge.
You're right. It is rather challenging. The music from Star Wars, and we're actually doing two suites from Star Wars, one from the original Star Wars movie from the 1970s, as well as the more recent Phantom Menace. They're both very challenging for both, especially the brass section. And as a brass player myself, I know I have to pace myself when it comes to music like this, but the payoff is the music is especially exciting for us to play. So whether it's Beethoven or John Williams, it's an amazing thing that we're able to put this together.
We're going to dig into some specifics in terms of the program with Maestro Robert Hasty, but maybe you can give us at least a partial rundown of some of the great films that we will be sampling over the course of tomorrow night's concert.
Sure. Another suite that we're doing is from Raiders of the Lost Ark, also by John Williams, roughly from the early 80s, if I remember correctly, but even more recently that franchise has continued. We're also doing, as you said, selections from Schindler's List, another composition by John Williams, as well as Mozart's 25th Symphony from the movie Amadeus and Batman.
A wonderful lineup. You and I are talking, actually recording this interview on Wednesday morning. So by no means has the orchestra deeply rehearsed all of these pieces yet. But I should think that a concert like this is incredibly fun, if challenging, for the orchestra to play.
We start rehearsals on Thursday.
So as we're hearing this interview Friday morning, rehearsals will have just begun. And I should think you have to have all hands on deck and really working hard to pull it all together. Tell us about what this whole season of the Kenosha Symphony has been like.
Well, it's been, to be honest with you, it's been a mixed set of emotions that we've had, because normally we do 4 concerts a year. And this year we had to make a difficult decision to go down to 3. I'm hoping next year we'll be able to go back to our usual 4 concerts. But of course, we rely on the support of our sponsors and the Kenosha community. So if you're able to donate, that would definitely help us. But yeah, it's been a very satisfying year. We did Beethoven 3 back in the fall. We had a Christmas concert that was sponsored by our fabulous sponsor, Snap-on Incorporated, and many, you know, over 300 people came to that, so we're especially excited that we were able to do that for the community.
And now finishing out in this really, really exciting fashion with this cavalcade of great film music. So if people are interested in attending tomorrow night's concert, what do they need to do in order to secure tickets?
Yes, we can. You can go to KenoshaSymphony.org to purchase a ticket. That will send you to a link through Eventbrite. You can also come to the door and purchase a ticket there, either through cash or a credit card. Tickets are $30 for adults and free for students and children.
Very good. Well, it promises to be a really, really exciting concert. I hope a lot of people will make a point of making their way to Reuther High School Auditorium tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., for a concert that's going to include all kinds of spectacular film music. And one of the talented musicians on the stage playing as part of the French horn section, Pete Rodriguez, president of the board. Pete Rodriguez, thank you for joining me today on the morning show. Best wishes with tomorrow night's concert.
Thank you, Greg.
Listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD, I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow night, on the podium, conducting the Kenosha Symphony in this concert of great movie music, will be none other than Maestro Robert Hasty. And we're going to talk with him for the next few minutes about how he put together this program of great movie music and the kind of challenges which it poses to him and to the orchestra. Maestro Hasty, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
So once it was determined that this May 4th coincidence made it a great opportunity to do movie music, where do you even start in such a vast array of possibilities? Where do you even start in terms of figuring out how to put together an exciting and doable and satisfying program?
Well, the obvious way to go regarding that, when the board directed that May the 4th would be a great opportunity to do a movie music concert, the obvious reference is Star Wars. I am a Star Wars junkie, so I am always willing to do music from Star Wars. But you can't make an entire concert. Well, I guess you could. You could probably do an entire concert of Star Wars, but my job as music director is to guide audiences, guide the community, and to make them see that movie music is a legitimate form of music that they can learn about. So I'm using the music of Star Wars as a method to show the audience how important movie music has been across time. So we can have two distinctions in this concert. We have music that's written for the movies, and then we have existing music used in movies. So, for instance, we're not going to just reference music by John Williams. We're also going to be having composers such as Danny Elfman, John Barry, Michael Kamen, and the great Henry Mancini. These are all important composers that really kind of look to what we often would call legitimate classical composers who started writing for for movies. So I'm referring to composers like Bernard Herrmann for Psycho, William Walton for Henry V, Eric Korngold for Robin Hood, and Serge Prokofiev, Lieutenant TJ, which the Kenosha Symphony performed last December. You know, when I was growing up, I fell in love with orchestral music because of Star Wars and because of John Williams. And at the time, back in the late 70s, especially with two parents who were classically trained musicians, there was this stigma that it wasn't real, that it wasn't legitimate. And I just fought against that, especially the fact that a kid like me could fall in love with orchestral music and be more interested in classical music because of this amazing scoring. I probably would not be as interested in music the way that I am now if it wasn't for the music of John Williams. So I decided that putting this concert together, I'm going to use music that was written for the movie as well as music that's written that was used in the movies. So I'm using this as an opportunity to bring up Mozart. Mozart's music was used in the movie Amadeus, which was a movie about him, using him as a subject. So using the Symphony No. 25 in G minor, if you saw the movie Amadeus, you would recognize it immediately from the beginning of the movie. We're also doing a piece by Mascagni from his opera Cavalleria Rusticana. His intermezzo was used in the movie Raging Bull, as well as Godfather Part 3. So it's a great way for me as a music director to kind of find an excuse to show the audience there's important classical music that was used in movies that you were interested in. And here's where they have been used. But then you also have, as I mentioned, the list of composers, with the most obvious one being John Williams, that was written specifically for the movies. However, all of these composers, including John Williams, used their classical background to help inspire the story. So I'm going to just be a little music nerd right now and talk about the leitmotifs that Richard Wagner made famous with his operas.
Right.
John Williams used this all over the place, and one of the pieces that we're going to be doing on Saturday is music from The Phantom Menace, Star Wars Episode 1. And as I was getting this ready to conduct, I noticed that in one of the movements called Anakin's Theme, it's very lovely, it's very beautiful, it's about a boy who, spoiler alert, fast forward through this podcast if you don't know that he becomes Darth Vader. But the fact that John Williams knows that, as he develops this theme, I noticed at the very end of the melody, he uses the flat six followed by a flat third and then the tonic. So, dee-da-da-dum, you have those that minor triad or arpeggio used, and then that which he had already written for the Imperial March, in episode 5 and so on and so forth that we all think of as Darth Vader's theme. But and so when I realized more and more over time that John Williams is helping the story along by using this, what we call the leitmotif, I just think it's absolutely amazing. And I discover new things when I'm conducting the music of John Williams.
Tell us what kind of a challenge it is to put together a program like this. And this is not certainly the first time you've contended with this, but a program that in a sense is a succession of miniatures versus a program in which we start with an overture and then a concerto and then there's intermission and then there's a symphony, which might, in terms of time, be a comparable amount of music. But when we're talking about 3 minutes of this and 4 minutes of this and 5 minutes of this, all evening long, what kind of a special challenge is that for you and for your musicians?
Well, it's obviously there's going to be a larger quantity of titles that are in the program. And I would say that I have to look to my friends who are conducting choral music and our friends who are conducting wind band music, because most of their pieces and most choral works and most band works are usually between 7 and 10 minutes long. And so they're used to doing a huge variety of pieces, whereas you can go to an orchestra concert and hear only 3 pieces in there. And when I say only, that still is going to be a full concert because of what you just said, the traditional overture, concerto, and then a symphony. It's definitely more challenging, especially somebody who's classically trained like me. I need to do more research in what we often call pops. Repertoire. I think the fact that we call a lot of this music pops, which is true by definition, but sometimes it makes it seem less legitimate, the importance of this music. What would movies be like without the music of Henry Mancini? What would the music be like without, if Korngold hadn't written the music of Robin Hood? So when I look back on this, you're going to have, as you said, a bunch of miniatures that reference specific movies. But what I hope to do is that the audience is going to leave going, this music is legitimate, just like Brahms or Beethoven, that we have to give this, the due attention that it deserves. I mean, we have to think that this isn't the first time this has happened. We have to go back into the 1900s when Brahms realized that the most popular composer was Johann Strauss because he wrote dance music. And we're kind of in that phase right now where we now have to look at movie music as legitimate. And interestingly, now it's about video game music. I have to admit, I'm not well versed on video game music, but you can see a lot of orchestras are going that route as well. So yeah, it is a challenge because you're looking at a lot of smaller pieces. But I would, when we perform Star Wars at the end of this concert, when we're talking about Star Wars, the one that I grew up calling Star Wars, which now people call Episode 4, it's 24 minutes and it's 4 movements long. It feels like a symphony. Mm-hmm. So that helps a lot too.
Wow. Well, there's a lot to look forward to in Saturday night's concert, tomorrow night's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. On the podium, Maestro Robert Hasty. Thank you, Maestro, for joining us for this portion of the morning show. Great to talk with you.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Thank you.
This exquisite music by John Williams is from the film Schindler's List. This is the main theme. And this is one of the examples of magnificent movie music that will be part of tomorrow night's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And this main theme from Schindler's List is going to be played by the Kenosha Symphony and its concertmaster, Sasha Mandel, rendering that exquisite violin solo. And I'm honored to speak with Sasha Mandel for the next few minutes about this particular piece of music and what it is like for him to have this opportunity to play it. Sasha Mandel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be with you here in the show.
And of course, people who have been frequent visitors to Kenosha Symphony concerts over the recent years have certainly seen you on the stage. How long have you been concertmaster for the Kenosha Symphony?
Oh, I think next year will be my 15th season, so 14 years.
Very good. A great legacy.
Yeah.
So I would be curious to know, as this concert began to take shape, at what point you became aware of this opportunity for you to play this marvelous, haunting, iconic solo from the score to Schindler's List?
In the beginning of this announced, we get the entire, repertoire lineup for what programs are going to be. I was very happy to see that Maestro Hasty had programmed this wonderful concert of, film music that we have coming up, or music that was featured in films. And, Schindler's List was listed there. I didn't know if it was going to be the entire music from it or not. But just the fact that we have the main theme from it there, and Maestro Hasty had me play that theme a few years ago in a different concert. So I was delighted that it was programmed and I got the opportunity to perform it again. And hopefully do a wonderful job at it.
Mm. Tell our listeners what it is about this piece and the way that John Williams has crafted this melody that gives it such a haunting beauty, and maybe also talk about the ways in which it is a stiff challenge to play. What sort of challenges does it pose, both technically and maybe expressively?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The piece itself, it's extremely poignant. It has a certain je ne sais quoi de melancholic sentiments to it. John Williams, of course, is a master of melody, and in particular how effective he is to play with the emotions. It's highly evocative, and even if one had not seen the movie and known what it was about, the music itself just calls this to this deep, introspective, reflective of how the melodic line works. So, having the challenges, let's say, for the violinist to play is always with a descending fifth, right, interval he has. It starts with an A and a D, ta-da-da-da. And that interval the interval that we tune our strings, most of the string instruments, but it's not like we're playing that way because you want to be very expressive. It comes here to the performer, in playing that perfect interval absolutely in tune, creating a relationship that one feels that sorrow, sort of almost a yearning and crying aspect to it. It's interesting to note that Gustav Mahler used that same idea of that interval in his Eighth Symphony, Symphony of a Thousand. He has a passage in the second section that sounds very much similar, and of course, that John Williams was a great admirer of Mahler's orchestrations and the melodic material too. But the extent that he has, it poses a challenge to the performance. Since, let's say, I mean, most string players, what do we call chin people, violinists and violists, we're always fingering in the space of four notes in the left hand. And to have that interval of the fifth poses a certain stretch to the hand that very big hands. I don't have the biggest hand. Can be easy, but can also be a challenge. When Itzhak Perlman, of course, was chosen to record the music by John Williams, I mean, Itzhak has a gigantic hand. I mean, his hands are very large, very supple, almost feels sort of like as soft as a boxing glove, actually. But his extent is huge in the left hand. So Itzhak, can flinch to play those intervals, and he plays it so sweetly. Also, another challenge is the orchestration that John Williams has. The violin can't necessarily play the tune as powerfully as we were being doing, let's say, in a Brahms violin concerto, or let's say even a solo from take piece. It is a very tender movement and melody in that sense, although it goes from the lowest note on the violin to actually quite high register. But one has to be very polished in playing and never going beyond the natural tonal capacities of what the violin has. It is a melody that, for having had relatives that were victims of the Holocaust, is something that hits very personal to me. It is a personal feeling, playing that and knowing what the film was about, of course, and the history of my ancestors. It's something that, it moves you while you're playing. So one can't get, necessarily sidetracked by heavy memories of what your ancestors went through in that time and how it connects vividly to the movie. So, I mean, one has to put on that hat of performer at the time and make sure that the music comes forward in a very effective manner.
Right. Well, I know a whole lot of people, myself included, are eagerly awaiting all of tomorrow night's concert, but in particular, this particular moment when you will be playing with the symphony this haunting theme from Schindler's List. Sasha Mandel, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show. I wish you and all of your colleagues the very best with tomorrow night's concert.
Thank you so much, Greg. Bye-bye.
If you would like information about tomorrow night's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, 7:30 at Ruther High School Auditorium, you can call the Kenosha Symphony at 262-220-7526 or visit their website, kenoshasymphony.org. And tickets for tomorrow night's concert will also be available at the door. Finishing out this first portion of today's morning show, here is the remainder of the exquisite main theme to Schindler's List, music of John Williams. It's exactly 8:40. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This amazing and iconic music is the opening to Karl Orff's dramatic cantata, Carmina Burana. This extraordinary, one-of-a-kind masterwork is going to be performed a couple of weeks from now, May 18th and May 19th, Saturday and Sunday, both performances 2 o'clock in the main stage theater at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, under the auspices of the Choral Arts Society. And their founder and artistic director, Jim Schatzman, is joining me in the studio today to talk about this exciting pair of performances, which will feature a collaboration with the Studio of Classical Dance Arts. And we're going to be talking about the origins of this work and why this particular performance, which will combine musical performance with dance performance, is very much at the heart of what Karl Orff had in mind in crafting this amazing masterwork. Jim Schatzman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Craig.
Glad to have you here. And it may seem a little strange to be talking about this upcoming set of performances so far ahead of time, except I think you anticipate that every ticket may be sold, because this is certainly an exciting event.
Absolutely. We anticipate the pre-ticket sales have been very robust. And so you have a couple of weeks to get tickets. I would definitely get on that if you're interested in coming to this concert. It's going to be a remarkable feast for the ears and for the eyes.
So first, let's talk about the fact that Carmina Burana is something that Choral Arts has done before, at least on one occasion, maybe two occasions before this. Tell us about the ensemble's history with this incredible piece.
Yeah, this will be our third performance of Carmina Burana. It is, as you said, an iconic work and one of those choral pieces that just, you know, it's performed hundreds of times worldwide. It's kind of like, I think of it as our Handel's Messiah. You know, there was a time when Messiah, you could hear Messiah every year in every community. And Carmina Burana is becoming that piece for many symphony orchestras. And so we definitely wanted to be a part of the energy of that, as well as doing something with the work as Karl Orff intended, which is more rarely done, which is featuring dancers and movement as part of this iconic work that's been part of movies and commercials, and it really is a cultural icon.
So tell our listeners what you can about the origins of this work, which I think, if I remember correctly, was composed maybe in the early 1930s?
Yeah, 1937, I think, is when it made its premiere. And Orff was, interestingly enough, you know, I mean, his colleagues are, his contemporaries are Strauss and Mahler, and you know, who are writing also these monumental works, Alpine Symphony and the, you know, Symphony of a Thousand and the Resurrection Symphony, these massive pieces. But Orff had a very different idea of what he was trying to create, and apparently this happened at a very young age. His biographer essentially says that Orff has to be considered self-taught. Mm. Although he had some formal training, he grew up in an extremely musical household, began composing in his earliest years, like Mozart, 8, 9 years old, he's composing pieces. When he did get some formal training, he resisted all of the training he got. He didn't like he didn't prefer the thick, contrapuntal sounds of Mahler and Strauss, but a somewhat less dense, more clear, more transparent form of music, and with the idea that it would grab you emotionally immediately. It wasn't academic work. You didn't have to struggle to figure out, what's this composer trying to tell me? He really thought his music didn't need to be analyzed. Mm. You know, there was no academic rigor to figure out how his phrase structure worked. Mm. It's folk song like and the chord structures hit you immediately. It's almost as if he's more in tune with movie scores than others. The music is meant to move you emotionally immediately. Mm. It hits you, you know what it's saying, and it evokes a reaction. Mm. And that's really what Carmina Burana is built around.
And, of course, what makes it so distinctive is not just Carl Orff's singular voice as a composer, but also the interesting choice that he makes in terms of the text. Explain what these words are.
These are very interesting words, and they come from a genre of poetry written most often by disenfranchised monks who were essentially troubadours. Galliards, I think, is the particular name of these particular musicians who traveled around communities singing songs of human emotion, of love, of rejection, of terror, of death and dying, of young love, all these ideas that you would expect to hear. It was the rock music of the time, in a way. I mean, this is, you know, this is rock and roll. This is what we sing about. And so these poets and musicians went around the countryside singing, in some cases, in the court palaces as entertainments and as poetry that talked about the rawness of emotions and the realness of life and how life could be disappointing or terrifying or beautiful and wonderful or nature. These songs a lot of times talk about nature, the beauty of flowers, the beauty of the ocean, or the beauty of the sun. It's just these very real, natural, pastoral emotions that we sense every day. And Orff really takes these texts and molds them in a way where he takes you through a one-hour roller coaster ride of emotions, which is what I really love about this piece.
Right. You were going to suggest a second excerpt that we hear beside the very familiar O Fortuna, which, of course, opens the work. What was the other movement you were thinking we would listen to?
Ecce Gratum. And essentially, again, this is a movement about joy and about the joy in nature and the wonder of just being out in the outdoors. And so that, I think, is a really terrific reference to the kinds of things that Orff talks about.
So tell me exactly what you want me to play, and we will give our listeners the second sampling of Carl Orff's Carmina Burana.
Number 5, Ecce Gratum.
All right, and here it is in a performance conducted by Simon Rattle.
Thank you.
an excerpt from Carl Orff's dramatic cantata Carmina Burana. We are talking with Jim Schatzman about the upcoming performances by the Choral Arts Society on Saturday and Sunday, May 18th and May 19th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the Main Stage Theater in the Rita at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. This is probably a good time for us to mention that the Choral Arts Society is utilizing a particular arrangement by Mr. Orff of this work, an arrangement that I remember very fondly from the first set of performances you did, in which I was a part, that I think really underscores what you were talking about in terms of both the transparency and the immediacy of Orff's music. Explain the nature of the arrangement that you will be utilizing.
Well, this piece is most commonly heard in an orchestral framework. It's heard in a symphony hall with an orchestra. But Orff intentionally arranged this piece for two pianos and essentially the same battery of percussion. And he wanted to make sure that this was accessible to smaller organizations. And it really was part of Orff's mission. I mean, you know, Orff at a young age saw an African troupe and saw how they moved with percussion. And it changed his outlook on how music can kind of grab a hold of people. And, you know, anybody who knows Orff's history knows that, you know, his Orff method of teaching children music and involving instruments scaled to their size and understanding that, you know, that children naturally move and naturally want to invent rhythms. And so, you know, using that in a way to educate and really excite young people about engaging in music and composing and creating was really a unique way of educating children about music. Again, less academic and more tactile. You grab an instrument, you grab a stick and you beat the instrument, or you play a bell and you move as well, that this evokes movement. And so what we often forget about Carmina Burana is that was intended to be danced. Mm. It was intended to be seen. That's generally a pretty expensive production to bring both those forces together.
Sure.
So it's just not done as often. And the music is so stunningly iconic that hearing it on its own is not really less than. People come away very satisfied. But I can tell you, if you haven't seen it as a ballet, you've not really appreciated the full scope of what Orff was intending, nor the kind of emotional impact that you're hit by when you see dancers, you know, highlighting the emotions and the movements with, you know, thrilling throws and subtle movements and seeing that contrast of motion. And the Studio of Classical Dance Arts is a local treasure. If you haven't seen them or seen their Nutcracker in the holidays, you've really missed something special. This is one of the finest arts organizations in our community. And to be able to work together with Mark and Linda, the directors of the organization, is quite an experience.
So, as you said, this is the third time out for the Choral Arts Society doing Carmina Burana. And in that second set of performances, not long before COVID, you collaborated with them. Do you expect this to be largely the same in terms of, for instance, specific choreography and so on and kind of the look of it? Will it be essentially the same sort of thing?
The look is very, very similar. We've done some modifications. For those of them, of our audience who have seen this before, you'll see a remarkable difference in the tavern scene. We've really changed it. We're bringing props in. The men are using mugs, and it's more staged.
So that
section in particular in the tavern will have a very different look to it. But yes, the, you know, large Wheel of Fortune projected on the back of the wall very dramatically. The choir dressed in monk's robes, the dance team who has, you know, three or four costume changes, and some of them dramatically beautiful, very colorful, and one time very stark in the beginning and the end, where we're talking about fate with dramatic movements and dramatic monk's robes. It's quite a look, and it's something that Mark Darling and Linda Bennett have really captured in a way that when you bring the lighting in and the staging in. For the Choral Arts Society, this is something a little unusual. I mean, we're basically a choral organization that sings choral programs, and we've done a couple operas, but this is a whole new scope. This is a full-blown ballet with professional lighting, sound enhancements, props, and everything that you would expect in a contemporary ballet.
Wow. Very good. How many dancers, roughly?
I think there's about 25 wow. dancers. So, I mean, wow. it's big. This is not like a couple of people, yeah. Hanging around. This is a very – the design of the production is as epic as the music. And right. so you're going to get a full effect of what it means to see 20 dancers and 60 singers and a bevy of percussionists, exactly as Orff would have wanted it.
Fantastic. These performances are coming up Saturday, May 18th, and Sunday, May 19th, both performances 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the main stage theater of the Rita Talent Pickens Regional Center for the Arts and Humanities at UW Parkside. All seating is reserved, and as you said, already ticket sales have been pretty robust, so people should not waste time in ordering a ticket. If they want to get tickets, what should they do?
They can go to our website or the Studio Classical Dance Arts website and just click on the homepage. There's a place right in the homepage to get your tickets reserved. Because they are reserved seating, you'll be able to select the seat that you would like. If you'd like to sit on the main floor or you're a balcony-type person, you'll be able to select that seat for you and your family. And tickets are likely to be available at the door, but I don't know if I'd push that.
Right.
Get those tickets early.
Absolutely. To experience this extraordinary masterpiece, Karl Orff's dramatic cantata, Carmina Burana. Jim Schatzman, founder and artistic director of the Choral Arts Society, thank you for being here, and we certainly look forward to these exciting performances of Carmina Burana coming up on May 18th and May 19th.
Absolutely. Thank you, Greg.
It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for gradually clearing skies. We're headed for a high today of 69 degrees. We should have mostly sunny skies tomorrow. Just a slight chance of a shower with tomorrow's high 73 degrees. Sunday, sunshine and cooler temperatures, a high of 63. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, NPR News and